friends. As the first speaker pointed out, the subject of our lecture today is overcoming desire. We first need to really place desire in the human constitution. Theosophically, we say man is made up of 7 constituents, 7 principles, and there are 4 lower and 3 higher principles. There is animal man, there is human man, and there is divine man. And what constitutes this animal man is the physical body, astral body, prana, and kama. Kama means passions and desires. And then there is the mind, which we can say constitutes human man, human soul. And then there are the higher principles, Atma, Buddhi, which are really the divine, which constitutes divine man. So it is kama, or passions and desires, which is one of the constituents of human being. And when we talk about overcoming desire, we also need to see how many different kinds of desires are there in man. If you take Buddhist view, you have 3 major groups. Kama tanha, which are sense gratification, all your senses take your mind in certain direction. You see something, you hear something, you taste something, you feel something, and the mind gets entangled in them. So these are all the desires connected with the senses. Then there is a bhava tanha. It has many meanings, but one of them is the desire to live on, what we call in the vernacular as jijivisha. You have that desire to live on. And there is the vibhava tanha. This also is a desire for spiritual experiences. So these are the 3 kinds. Otherwise we know, very broadly we know these desires as being either worldly desires, personal desires, and we are most of the time playing with and saturated with these, which are the worldly and personal desires to achieve something, to get something, to experience something, which is all of the worldly nature. Name, fame, power, position, money, and so on will all form these worldly desires. As against that, there would be higher good desires also. So then we have to be careful, and we should also know that desire is really the driving force. It is a motor power. If I want to achieve something, there must be first desire in me to achieve it. Whether it is something bad or something good, there must be first desire. And then, based on the desire, theosophy would say that the power of will is drawn. Theosophically, we say behind will stands desire. This is a hermetic saying. Behind will stands desire. We very glibly talk about willpower. If someone achieves something, say the first class in his examination or a very high position or whatever may be his ambition, you tend to say, oh, he has a great willpower. Well, spiritually speaking, if you see, then that is not a very great willpower, because behind which, what kind of desire is there? It's a worldly desire. So the amount of power which is drawn is nothing great. What is this willpower? This willpower is nothing but the force of spirit in action. Everything flows from your Atma. We may recognize or not recognize that Atma, spirit, which is the God within man, which Krishna says in the Gita, I am the ego seated in the hearts of all beings. Whether we accept or not, ultimately all the power comes from that Atma, and that Atma, when it comes into play, is what we know as willpower. But here we need to understand, which very beautifully has been put by Robert Crosby, think of this willpower as sunlight outside your room, and you have lots of windows and doors, but if you have really kind of put cardboard over that window, no sunlight will come. If you make a small hole, only that much sunlight will come. You make bigger holes and more sunlight will flow in. What are these holes symbolizing? He says these holes are desires. We have reduced the power of will to pinholes of desire. Our desires like the hole made by a pin, very tiny. It may be very great. I want to become IAS officer, I want to become a chartered accountant, I want to become a chief minister. As compared to spiritual life, it's like a tiny hole you have made, and to you it looks like a great will and force and determination which is shown by the person. But as compared to that, if you had a higher desire, a spiritual desire, the amount of willpower which you can draw is enormous. So here we are able to see that there are desires and desires. Most of the time we are playing in and satisfied with only the worldly personal desires. Now, if these desires are in us, and if we are thinking of really living the spiritual life, some of these desires, as we shall see, will become obstacle. Otherwise, why would we think about purifying desire, overcoming desire, transmuting desire, killing out desire? These are all these words which the scriptures use. So, there is something like these desires posing an obstacle. The very big thing which the Buddha has to say in light of Asia is that what grief springs of itself and springs not of desire? Senses and things perceived, they kind of coalesce and light a quick spark of fire. So, according to Buddha, the root cause of your pain and suffering is desire. Of course, what desire is again remains to be seen. Now, if there is desire principle in man, yatha pinde tatha brahmande, what is there in man is also there in the cosmos. So then, how do we see this desire there? And you have the Rigvedic hymn which says, desire arose in it, the primal germ of mind. And then, we are also being told in the Hindu scriptures about Kamadeva. And similarly, in the Western scriptures or Western philosophy, it is spoken of as Eros. So we have never, apart from what science tells us about Big Bang theory, etc., we have never really thought about how and whence this universe philosophically. And there we are being told that it is this Kamadeva, that desire arises in it, has been described as, it sets fire to the absolute Parabrahma, Paramatma, whatever name you want to call that one reality. It, as it were, sets the ball rolling. It actually gives an impulse for this universe to come into existence. So there is this Kamadeva, which is there very much in the first quotation. What is that Kamadeva? It is not just the force which really brings the universe and everything in the universe into existence. It is a very divine desire. It is compared with compassion. Because what is the whole, aim for bringing the universe into existence, you and me and the stones and flowers and all that? It is for the purpose of growth and evolution. That let every being, every creature progress and reach perfection. So for that purpose, the universe comes into existence. As Patanjali says, universe exists for the experience and liberation or emancipation of the soul. So at two levels, we are able to see this desire principle in man and in cosmos. Now when we turn to the desire in man, we don't have to go very far. In the Bhagavad Gita second chapter, Arjuna is confused. People know what is wrong and yet they go ahead and do it. What is it that really propels them? And Krishna says, Kama esha, krodha esha, rajoguna samudbhava. Both desire and anger, they arise out of the quality of rajas. There are three qualities, sattva, rajas and tamas. Everything is made up of these three qualities. So from the rajogun arises this desire, and that is the desire which impels man even to do something which he knows wrong and yet against his will he is doing. And then Krishna proceeds to say, There are three kinds of desires, sattvic, rajasic, tamasic. Beautiful illustration given by Krishna, that one illustration is just like the fire or a flame is surrounded by smoke, just like your fetus is surrounded by womb. And the second example that he gives is where the mirror is covered by the rust. These are the three kinds of desires which envelop the whole universe. It envelops in man his thinking principle as well as his discriminative faculty. Once you are obsessed by desire, you forget sara asara viveka. This is what also in the second chapter we are told, that he who attendeth to the inclination of senses, in them hath a concern. From concern arises passion, from passion delusion, from delusion loss of memory, loss of memory arises loss of discrimination, and then loss of all. So just see how true it is. Depends on desire. So if you take sattvic desire, and one may wonder, how can sattvic desire also be an obstacle? Obstacle to what? Obstacle to self-realization. Obstacle to really experience the infinite glory of the spirit. Sattvic desire is desire for knowledge, desire for obtaining peace, bliss, happiness and perfection. But if all of this I desire for myself, then this is an obstacle. So the example given is of the occult novel Zanoni, in which we are given example of an adept, a wise being in a way, named Majnur. And the author describes him by saying that as far as Majnur is concerned, what does he say? He says, my life is in knowledge and I am not concerned with humanity. He gives no charity and desires not to receive any charity. So he is not expecting anyone to give him any help, physical, mental or otherwise, nor does he really give help to others. If that is so, and he does no evil, but he also does no good. He confers no good and he does no evil. What kind of a person is this? This is the person who is only a secluded, knowledgeable man. Maybe spiritual knowledge, but he is secluded. He is cut off from humanity. Can you really make spiritual progress by having a lot of knowledge, but not having any concern for anyone else but for yourself? So this also is a sattvic desire, but an obstacle which will debar you from having that self-realization. And the rajasic desire, we are all aware, because we are all running after money, name, fame, power, position all the time. This certainly will take a great effort. The sattvic desire is like the smoke surrounding the flame. Little breeze and the smoke is gone and you can clearly see the flame. Same thing, you have to make little effort to overcome this self-sufficiency and seclusion, and we will be able to make progress. The third is the fetus surrounded by womb. Can you see the fetus which is in the womb? No. It's completely obscure. So the tamasic desire is concerning the indifference, laziness. Someone who really doesn't want to exert himself, neither for good nor for evil. He is lazy, he is indifferent. He takes what comes and he's like a wood in a river. You know, if you put wood and that wood gets drifted here and there where the river currents will take. So there are people who just live the life as it comes. They do not have any specific desire, anything to achieve, nothing. This is the very worst state to be in, being tamasic. It takes a great effort, therefore, to first come on the right path and then make your progress. So this is what we are told in the Gita. Now, if we want to really overcome desire, where do we start? Whether it is tamasic, whether it is rajasic, whether it is sattvic, wherever we are on the ladder of evolution, And again, Sri Krishna says, the easiest thing is, you begin with the senses. Control the senses. It does make sense. We have a great addiction for pizzas, or you have great addiction for drinks and drugs, great addiction for plum cakes, great addiction for buying new clothes. Lots and lots of things are there. Your mind all the time is drawn in that direction, and when you see that thing, you can't resist buying it, eating it, whatever it is. So the best thing is that you remain away from that place. Simple things, food. You don't go to the place where that food is being cooked. Don't go to the place where the food is being sold. Don't allow your eyes or your senses to linger over that thing. A young man once said, I practice ek nazar. Must have been an Islamic person, so he's saying, I practice ek nazar. That means, if I see a beautiful girl, I just give one glance. After that, I resist the temptation of not looking at her over and over again. Makes sense. Okay, so we do the kind of control of the senses. We don't look at those things, we don't smell that, we be away from that. And so if you don't see it, smell it, hear it, you are not tempted. Very fine. But can we really stop at what the Gita says, that like a tortoise draws in his head and his limbs inside the shell, you draw in all your senses. That is only the first step, but we can't stop there. And therefore the quotation, one of the quotations says from the Buddha that, well, it begins with, good is control in the eyes, good is control in the ear, good is control of the nose. But finally you have to move to controlling your body, your speech and your mind. Now think about the physical senses. Additionally, those who have advanced a little, we talk about them as psychics. They have psychic experiences. Their psychic astral senses have developed. So they look into the astral and they have experiences of the kind of golden ball, then the bells ringing, and there are all kinds of very fascinating experiences they have. You and I would never have experienced. It would be something like a person taking drug and lost in a beautiful world, fanciful world, which is a best analogy we can give. But this also is to be taken into account. As you proceed, maybe you have overcome the temptations of physical senses. There is a great temptation of these psychic world. And you can get lost in the psychic world and want to experience it over and over again. So, what about powers? Desire to get powers and desire to exercise powers. I know healing and I want to exercise healing and then get praise from people. I have the power to tell future, I exercise it and then I want praise from people. It becomes a desire because it gives me prestige, it gives me praise from people. So there are 100 chords of desire, as Krishna says, at different levels in different ways. And as we said, we can't therefore stop at simply controlling the senses, whether be physical or astral. Because the culprit is the mind. And as we've seen from this platform so many times, what is it that constitutes really perception? I heard this. I saw this. I felt it. It is only and only experienced when mind comes into picture. Your eyes bring the data. They are taken through the optic nerve to the brain and then to the mind. It is mind which will interpret and give you that this is the thing. Senses will only be able to tell you some sensation. Cold, bright, red, rough, whatever may be the sense which is operating. And therefore, we say, if you put one spoon of ice cream on your tongue, tongue will say, it is cold, it is sweet. It is mind which intervenes and says, oh, I like it, I want more of it. So, it is the mind which is the culprit. It is the mind which is the arouser. of this which we call as craving. I like it, I want more of it. And then you want second helping and third helping. You see a dress in the window display, and then again you are having that arising of the craving, and you want to buy it, and you won't be at rest till you have bought that dress, and so on. So here we are able to see that once that you have learned to control the senses, the next thing is the mind. The real culprit is the mind, and therefore we need to control the mind. It is the mind which really needs to be controlled. Your eyes may see things, but it is the mind, if it is controlled, then you will not be running after that thing. That's why in the voice of the silence we are told, don't allow your senses to make a playground of your mind. Also, see the hitch which lies in only controlling the senses. Many times, you see, those people who have not a completely right idea of what we call sannyas, they simply renounce everything and go away from samsara or the world. What happens then? They will live a life where it might be a remote place, it might be quite cut off from the worldly life. So you are within the four walls of a ashram, within the four walls of a monastery. You are not likely to meet people, you are not likely to be seeing beautiful things and sights and food and things like that, whatever is cooked in the ashram or monastery. Your life flows very smoothly. But does that really mean that we have got control? And the answer will be no. There are lots of stories are there. You have W. Somerset Maugham's story called Rain, in which there is this clergyman. Of course, it's not as if he lives only in the monastery, but prematurely he has become clergy, tries to remain away from all these influences, but he thinks that he is very nearly a detached person. So once he is traveling and he sees in a ship a prostitute, and he decides that he'll reform her. So once they get down to the destination, happen to be staying somewhere close, and he says, I will come and stay with you, and then I will teach you how to become a good Christian. And he lives for a week or so. Then he has committed suicide because he finds that he is not able to resist the temptation. And he falls in his own eyes, falls down in his own eyes. This is exactly what happens when you have not really met the temptation and overcome it. We have a very fine line coming. It's a very long passage, but a very fine line coming from John Milton, who says, I am no believer in cloistered and fugitive virtue. Absolutely apt words. Virtue is cultivated, but under ideal condition. There are no temptations. There is no one who will make me angry. There is nothing which will tempt me to become dishonest. It is all in ideal surrounding, and I say, I am a very honest person, I am a very calm person, I don't get angry. But you have never faced any situation where you have an occasion to lose anger. It's a cloistered virtue, which you have developed within four walls of ashram or within four walls of your home. And fugitive. Those who take sannyas prematurely are what we call in vernacular language as bagedu. They have run away. They are not facing the temptation. So what is this overcoming desire if you have not even faced the temptation? If I mistake not, the movie Sansara is bringing about this very point. Someone is simply taking a sannyas, then he comes back and he says, oh, but let me first enjoy Sansara and then leave. Otherwise, what am I leaving if I have not even enjoyed? You leave when you are able to see what it is and overcome it. So, mere controlling of the senses will not bring you to that state. The control of the mind will become necessary. Then you also find there is something which the psychologists call as momentary madness. They do a lot of work on it, and the psychotherapists say, yes, there is something called momentary madness, so that there are perfectly upright good people. And you hear, in the mood of the moment, he murdered. In the mood of the moment, he slept another person. In the mood of the moment, he raped a girl, and so on. What is this mood of the moment when it is done? So here again, we are able to see a line of thought given by the psychoanalyst Eric Fromm, who is also in the whole of that book, he is making this point, that that mood of the moment is actually where you have lost the power to make a choice. There, the passion has become overpowering. And how does it happen? And he gives an example that supposing a boy likes a girl, doesn't manage to say that, but they happen to be coming to office and going back home together. Now, over a period, he begins to think about her. He fantasizes. He thinks, suppose I take her for a movie and then we go to a garden, then I hold her hand and whatnot. But he's perfectly at ease because he thinks, I'm only thinking. I've not done anything to her. This is what Eric Fromm is saying. I'm only thinking, I've not done it. And then, what is happening? Unknowingly, you are building the passion. You are building that desire at mental level. All the same, you are building the desire. And therefore, one day when she says, okay, why don't you come in and have a cup of tea? And then the boy finds that there is no one at home, and the inevitable, which he never imagines he will do, happens. Because that is the mood of the moment where he doesn't have any more a choice to do it or not to do it. He's simply driven by the force of passion or desire. What does that show? To overcome desire, you have to be completely awake all the time. It's not that you allow it to kind of go on increasing and then in the end you say, how do I overcome it? Sometimes it may happen, but otherwise the best thing is be awake all the time. The moment you are going in a wrong direction towards something, whether it is food or whether it is money or whether it is power, you must wake up and take hold of yourself. And not allow it to, as it were, accumulate and go on multiplying till you have absolutely no control. Now, if you turn to Buddha, he has given the whole doctrine of conditioned co-production. This is called Pratitya Samutpada. And he is saying that you will be seeing this whole wheel of birth, death, rebirth, where everything comes as a result of or dependent on something, a cause which is previous to it. Like for instance, you take birth, you have a body, you have mind, you have senses, based on your past karma, your past vasanas, your past sanskaras, and based on that mind and the five senses, there is an ability to make sparsha or contact. Your senses will make contact with the world outside. Based on the sparsha or contact will come vedana or sensation. Sensation. As we said, ice cream. And the tongue will say it is cold and sweet. You saw a nice dress. Again, eyes will say good design, red color, whatever it is. So there is a sensation. But based on sensation will arise craving. Tanha and Trishna. I want it. I want to possess it. And so the Buddhists say, the Buddhist teacher Sangharakshita says, that the whole battlefield of spiritual life consists in breaking the chain between these two things. Passive feeling and active craving. Can I not stop?